Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records. Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track by track breakdown of all the songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to Talking Records. My name is Jed, and this is a podcast that takes albums and deep dives into them. We do old albums, we do new albums. We do whatever the hell we feel like doing. This is Talking Records, and we are going to be diving into the Bollweevils' brand new album, Essentials, that is going to be out May 5th. The Bollweevils formed in Chicago back in 1989. With a handful of releases on Doctor Strange Records, Underdog Records, and the band's own Go Def Records, the band built a steady following, touring with such bands as 88 Fingers Louie and the Smoking Popes. However, in the mid-90s, vocalist Daryl left to pursue medical school, and the band remained quiet until a one-off show in 2003, and then another in 2006. I discovered the band in 1997 when I picked up a split 7-inch record between a local band called The Marshes and another band called The Feds. I hadn't heard of The Feds, picking up the record only because it had The Marshes on it. I was quite pleased when I flipped the record over. Upon looking into the band, I learned that Ken had been in a band called the Bollweevils. So, naturally, I checked them out too. I grabbed Stick Your Neck Out, the band's Doctor Strange debut, and I loved what I heard. It was fast, it was catchy punk rock, and it could be both serious and very silly. This music was right up my alley. So, fast forward all this time, and we've got a brand new record. Essential was tracked in their hometown, but they sent it to the blasting room to be mixed. They're naming the album after themselves because they're all essential workers, educators, first responders, and of course, leading the way is Dr. Daryl Wilson. The Bollweevils consist of Daryl Wilson on vocals, Pete Midler on bass, Ken Fitzner on guitar, Pete Mumford on drums. So without further delay, I would like to welcome Dr. Daryl Wilson to Talking Records. Hey, Daryl, welcome to Talking Records.
I'm glad to be here, man. Thank you for having me on.
I am super excited to have you. I'm super excited to talk about Essentials today.
Thank you. I'm excited to talk about it, too. It's a really good record.
It's been a long time coming.
Oh, yeah. It's been a long time coming. I was reminded recently I made an error. Well, actually, our social media people made an error. Then I saw the error that it was like, hey, like Heavyweight or, you know, LP came out 14 years ago. It's like, no, that's 28 years ago. It's 1995. I'm like, oh my God, that's so long. I'm like, oh my God, you're right. I'm like, guys, the time is off on that. It's like, that's ridiculous. 28 years since our last LP.
Wow.
So that's a lot of time.
That's a really long time.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, but I think we have a quality thing out. I can't say enough of how happy I am with the record that we put out. With Essential is really, really good. I'm going to back that, and I'm not typically one to boast about anything at all, but that it's a great record, and I'm really, really happy with it. I'm pleased that we have it out. And I think that the amount of time in between what we had recorded previously to now, I think the record really speaks volumes to having a quality record put out, and not just put out some stuff to put it out. So I'm really happy with it.
Well, very cool, Daryl. We are going to cover all that, the recording, the songs. We're going to really dive into this thing. So starting there, I heard that these songs actually span that entire time between records. You didn't just write these like in the last couple of years. These songs span all that time.
Pretty much. I mean, it's I'd have to say the bulk in thinking about this now through the multiple interviews that I've done so far, the bulk of the record, it came about probably in the past 8 years, but a lot of those songs have been worked and reworked for that span of time where we were, you know, stutter stepping and starting up and then not starting and then stopping again, having this arrested development of putting together the next LP. I mean, really, if you think about it, with Heavyweight was the last full length we put out. And then we had, of course, the other releases like History of Part Two came out.
Right.
And then it was like at that point, the band had like broken up. So, you know, I'd been kicked out of the band and, you know, for starting, you know, my profession as a physician,
right,
getting kicked out of the band. And then we really got back together and started playing again back in 2003. We played a show. Then 2006, we kind of started playing, you know, more consistently. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we started thinking, okay, we should write some new stuff. And we started putting some music together and we recorded some of the songs that came out on the 7-inch, the Attack Scene 7-inch. Mm-hmm. But that actually came out even after we had, you know, our parting with Bob, you know, when he left the band. And so our original bass player, and we recorded those songs with our bass player, Miguel, who was playing at the time. And, you know, we put them down. And then even afterwards, we were all not 100% satisfied with what we recorded. And we knew that we kind of just kind of threw it together because we kept saying, we have to record something. So yeah, we did. As we kind of moved on and finally gelled together with, you know, Pete Mittler as our bass player, who I think completed us and made us into the band that we were supposed to be, then we really had this push, this evolution, this whole thing where we had the right formula together to make the songs gel like they did, and started writing more and more, and then reworking those songs that we've been working on for all this time, and finally became, you know, satisfied with what we had, satisfied and not satisfied to say good enough done, but like, these are really, really good. These finally deserve to be shared with other people, not just playing them live, but shared and put down so that they have a permanence that's there. I think it was good that we took the time to do that. I think if we would have just put something out, we would have never been really fully feeling like that was who we were.
Mm-hmm.
And we always look back and say, God, I wish I redid that. We did do a couple of songs we had redone because we've evolved as a band over time. We did Bottomless Pit and Peggy Sue, and they're on the LP. Mm-hmm. But they're different songs now, but they're the same. They're us, but it's us now. It's who we are advanced to. It's who we've grown into and who we've, you know, matured into. And I think that's the one thing about this record. I think it has... It's us at the core. Everything has to be us at the core, or we wouldn't be genuine.
Right.
And it's got a maturity to it that when people say that, sometimes people shy away and go, oh my God, maturity means you're changing so much to a point. Well, no, I mean, you're still the core person that you are from the get-go. You just learn things, that you actually become more wise in the activities that you undertake. I think this has a wisdom to it, that I should say, versus maturity, that comes with doing this for such a long time and still loving what we're doing at the same time.
And I feel like you also get a lot of perspective, you know, doing it that long.
Yeah. And I think that comes off in the record too. When you're in the beginning and you're doing things and you record stuff, sometimes you're done. You just do it, throw it out there. It's like, this is the product and it's done. Mm-hmm. And people will like it because they're going to like or not. This had, you know, more meticulous time taken with it from the standpoint of, you know, it wasn't like you go and you do one take and you're done. It's like you go in and you do it till you have it down to the perfect, you know, perfect enough so you can say, this is perfect. I've recorded, I've done the best I could do for this, mm-hmm. versus that's pretty good. It's like, no, do your best, you know, and taking criticisms from everybody to say you can do better than that, and not, you know, going off in some direction where you feel like it's a personal attack. It's more so you're putting out this product together as a unit. So you should listen to what other people are saying to say, wait a minute, that doesn't sound quite right. Can you do that again? Or, hey, can you play something different? Or, hey, can you sing this differently? that's what I think this came down to, that we were going over it with a fine tooth comb to say, no, you got to do this and do it at your best. Don't just do it and do it great and make it great. Cause we're all on this together. And that's the thing about this record, I think, is really, really cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. So functioning like a whole, like a unit. Instead yes. of individuals. That's great.
Yes. Yes.
So
yes,
I'm wondering, awesome. While we're talking about this, do you know which one of these songs happens to be the oldest one? Is it?
Ooh, probably Peggy Sue's the oldest
Peggy
one.
Peggy Sue, yeah.
Because that's been recorded before, but the oldest of the ones that are the newer songs, the oldest one is probably Gulch. Mm. That, is one of the older ones. That and I think Theme, they came at the same time. They were all around. And, that and, Gulch is probably one of the oldest ones. Because that got reworked and reworked and reworked for the longest time. And initially when it was written, we actually questioned whether or not we liked it. That was one of the things. And Ken was insistent.
It was a little different.
It is. And Ken was like, this song is great. We're like, oh, okay, it's okay. And we play it. We're playing it live. We kept doing it. And we're like, okay. And then we kept reworking it and kept working on it. And then it finally got to a point like, yeah, this is a good song. Oh my God. He could see the structure of it and the bones of it and was insistent. Like, this song, we're going to keep doing this. And I remember, Pete Mumford and I were kind of like, okay, it's okay. It's okay song. It's not bad. But it wasn't like hitting us like, oh yeah, we persisted at it and we kept working at it. And then it's like, oh, this song is, it's really good. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
So that's kind of grew, organically over time and took shape to finally get, chiseled into the form that it finally took, which is an amazing thing.
Yeah. I love the acoustic intro. Definitely hear the Naked Ray Gun in there.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it just epitomizes all the things that we kind of are. And it once again, it has that level of growth and wisdom to it and maturity and it's us. And you can hear it and go like, wow, the beginning hits you. You go, oh, wait a minute. And then you're like, oh yeah, that's still them. And it hits you like, God, that's really good. And it evokes this, deeper seated, almost soul like hit. And you're like, yeah, that's good.
That's awesome. That's good. Well, it's definitely one of my favorite songs on the record. So
thanks, man. Thanks.
I want to talk about Pete for a second before we get into the actual recording of the record. Yeah. So along the way, you picked up Pete. So tell us a little bit about how you found Pete. And you were starting to say a little bit about what he brought to the band. But if you could elaborate a little bit more on that, that'd be great.
Pete, we've known Pete forever. I mean, he's been our friend for the longest time. He was our, our driver on our first tour.
Yeah.
He's been our friend for ages, right? And we were looking for a bass player. We had this whole, crisis of conscience of whether or not we were going to still be a band. We didn't know what we were going to do after we'd had our, Miguel had left, and we're thinking, God, we got to find a bass player. So Pete was available. And it's like thinking, why do you never think about Pete? That's something that seems so logical.
Hey guys, I play bass.
Right. It's like, oh, that seems logical. And then it's like, yeah, Pete shows up and it's like, oh, this is like putting on like an old hoodie. I mean, it's like perfect. Mm. I mean, this is like, this is a match made in heaven. We're supposed to be like, oh, probably not having to think about this as a band. It's probably a match made in hell, but it's definitely, he was like this linchpin, this whole puzzle piece that might have been missing for the longest time. And once you put the puzzle piece in, you're like, that's the picture. That's what it's supposed to be. And we make the joke all the time, everything's better with Pete, and it really is. It's like, just the interactions that we have because we're such close friends, and the ability for us to collaborate and work together, the ability to criticize each other and not take it, in a personal fashion. All those things were just perfect. It is huge. And, he brings this driving rawness to the rhythm section. And because Hit, Pete, and Pete both together are just a phenomenal rhythm section. It's like they are the driving force behind everything that pushes, you know, pushes the tempo. And they're like locked. They're simpaccato. They're locked in. Mm-hmm. And also it's like Pete's he's a gruff, tough looking dude, you know, and he fits into the whole, you know, thing of us as a Chicago band. And he, yeah. he just is, you know, he is, you look at him, you go, that guy's Chicago, right? You kind of look at him, go, that guy's a Chicago guy. Yeah. So he is our friend, cause he's definitely our brother and love him to death. He completed us. I mean, it sounds so cliche, like he completed us, but he did. He made us a full on unit, and like all these pieces together have to be working, you know, in sync. And we do. It's like we can get up there and go. It's like we never miss a beat when he's there. Literally, we never miss a beat when he's there. So I mean, that's it. He's our ace in the hole.
Well, that's great. Amazing. Yeah. When you can bring in somebody that just kind of completes the chemistry, that's so awesome.
Yes. Yes.
Because it can be nerve-wracking when you've been a band for so long and you bring in someone new and you're like, well, Pete's not new, but like still bringing in a new player can oftentimes really change things. And it sounds like it changed for the better.
Oh, yeah. It changed. Wow. I mean, like night and day. It was like you look back and go, should have been here all along. It's like one of those things you go, I don't know why you weren't here from the beginning. It doesn't make any sense to us because I can't see it any other way. I mean, it's like us as the, yeah, everything has its point when you've had your growth. Every moment, every member, everybody who's been a part of this has helped us to get to where we are.
Yeah.
And I think this is where we've reached this, like, this is our perfect form, right? That's what I made some Dragon Ball Z joke the other day that saying this is our Frieza final form. Like, you know, we come in, it's like Super Saiyan, whatever. It's like we are in this final form, and that is like, wow, we're hitting on all cylinders, and we have this power that seems unstoppable. And it's all because of each member and their contribution together that makes the whole unit full.
That's great. So taking that into the studio, where did you record this record?
Echo Mill in Chicago. And,
Echo
and
Mill.
Jeff Dean did the engineering on it. And we've known Jeff forever too. Mm-hmm. And it's Jeff really did like push everybody, you know, he for this, he's like, hey, listen, when you're doing the track and you're recording something, he's like, okay, so you did, that was a good track, but how about you do it again? And so I'd do it again. And like I said, I've always prided myself on just getting the tracks done and being done. One time I hit it, I'm done. It's good. It's perfect. And he's like, no, do it again. I'm like, what are you talking about? That was great. He says, perfect, yeah, that was good. Yeah. You can do better, but you know, you can do better. Like, are you sitting? That sounded perfect to me. He's like, nah, it's just a little something in there. I don't know what it is. And he would just keep pushing. He would just say, do it again, do it again. And sometimes you'd record something six times. And I'm like, what are you talking about? This is not how we do this. We're just in, done, go. But that's the kind of work that had to be put in to make it right. And it was perfect. You look back and go, that's why we had to do that six times, because you had to make sure that was right, that you had to get the right track for that. Don't settle. It was not settling for anything. It was just making sure that it's done. And you know, like, you know, Ken would play something like, hey, you got to play that again, man. Or, hey, did you think about playing it this way? And Ken might change what he's playing at that point. You know, hey, Daryl, did you think about singing with this intonation when you're singing instead of how you did it that verse that way? I'm like, that's the way I've been singing. He's nah, you should do it differently. And it came out the way that it should have come out. It's just that Jeff was really hard on us. And he was like, do it again, do it again, do it again. So it was great. It was great working at the Echo Mill. Jeff did, you know, phenomenal job engineering the whole thing. And he knows us, and he knows how to get the best out of us, which was great.
How to push you. Yeah. It's really great to have someone like that listening, because often as a player, you're like, well, I nailed it. You know, it sounds good. Right. But to have someone just listening to it and encouraging you to try it one more time, two more times, three more times, they really do get the best performance out of you.
Oh, and I think he builds up that anger sometimes. Especially when you're playing, yeah, yeah. You're like mad. It's like, why am I doing this for six times? Like, because you're like, it's like, oh God. And you finally get that last thing and you hit it and you're like,
yeah.
Yeah, that was the climb I needed to do to to make that right. You know, it's like I didn't realize I had that last little bit, but yeah. he knew. He's like, no,
got you can do angry that. Energy going into the vocals.
Exactly. It's like, keep going. I'm like, oh, come on, man. It's like, no, you're killing me. I have to do this again. Yeah, you do. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to kill you, man, but okay. And he's like, no, you got it. It's like, thank God. Yeah. Accomplishment.
Yeah.
You know, accomplishment is made.
So how do you guys like to record? Do you like to generally do instrument by instrument, or do you try to get like drums and basic rhythms down? How do you like to do it?
So it is. It's like it's almost everybody's there and I'm doing scratch vocals because they want to hear it because it helps to keep the timing. But it's getting the drums first and making sure the drums are right, because that's always the hardest part, is making sure you have all those drums. And then so it's everybody recording at the same time while drums are going over, and then we get the drums done, you know, bass will come in, do their part, and then it's guitars, and it's getting the guitars in and making sure the guitars are right, and then laying down the vocals and getting the vocals done, and then it's like those little backup vocals that are there. It is this whole process of like, okay, it's always making sure that the rhythm section is solid. That is your foundation, right? If the foundation is weak, everything else falls apart. And that's Pete Mumford he's an amazing, amazing drummer. He is by far one of the best drummers around. He is definitely a person who is about perfection on getting that stuff done too. And it grinds. It causes this undue pressure that you don't want to have, that sometimes makes you averse to recording because you're like, oh my God, this is way too much pressure. But he never folds. He just gets it done. He's always glad to be finished when the recording's done, but he gets it done and he works at it. And he's like, gets to a point where it's like, okay, going to get this down. It's got to be this way. You know, he'll think, yeah, maybe this fills, he's got to do it again, but he will make sure it is right. The foundation is always built really strong, and I'm glad that we have him as our brother in arms to do all this. He's been in the band for 20 years, so
yeah,
that is our guy. And you know, it's a family thing, right? All of us are family, so that's what it is. You know, we encourage each other while we also kind of, you know, razz each other too at the same time, but we're always encouraging each other because we know we want it to all be, it's all of us together going into this, and we want the product or whatever we do together to be all of us. It's not just individuals and they're, you know, standing up and taking it and being the glorious, you know, winner. It's like all of us are winning together. And that's the thing. But it starts with that bass. It starts with that foundation of the drums and then builds from there with the bass and then the guitars and then vocals get laid over it.
How much like goofing off do you guys allow yourselves when you're in the studio? So there's a little razzing going on.
Well, that happens 24. I mean, there's always razzing. It's like, you know, a part of that too is the understanding that there's a certain amount of bend you have to put in something to see how far you can push it before it breaks. And, you know, there's like somebody will talk about, you know, hey, they'll be serious about criticizing your vocal and my vocal or something. And at the same time, they'll make some joke about it when you walk back and you're listening to it, like, well, I could have sung that too, like this, you know, and trying to imitate me singing, which is like, you just want to punch, but you know, you don't.
Yeah.
Or like watching somebody play guitar and, you know, Ken's playing guitar and just staring at him and just, you know, trying to, you know, distract him, which right. It's like, hey, you got to calm down. Just like, take it easy. And he's like, just, you know, getting angry and just wanting to throw the guitar. But there's a lot of smack talk going on all the time. I think we live perpetually to try and see who can outdo the next person's smack talk. That is a special thing. But I think it keeps us sharp. It keeps us pretty quick on the, you know, turnaround for something. And it allows us to realize if we can be our worst critics, then nobody else can really make us feel that bad. Is the thing about it.
Yeah.
So it happens a lot.
if you can handle it in the studio, you can handle it out there in the world.
Oh God. Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. There's some pretty sick birds that happen on each other all the time.
Well, think about the studio. It's just so much time spent. You're spending all this time in this little space together, and you're just like, you're waiting for one guy to finish guitar and another guy to finish guitar. There's just a lot of like sometimes nothing for other members to do.
Right. And it's like, I'm going to talk a lot of smack about this guy next to me. Let's talk about you. But you do also, not only are we going to sit there and try and beat each other down, but it's also we lift each other up. And it's that whole thing of like, man, that was awesome. You did a really great job on that. And letting people know, because we know we love each other. So we're going to kid. If we're not kidding with you, there's something wrong. Right. Mm. So we know there's a time to be very serious about what we're doing, but also this is about having fun. I mean, that's the big thing about it is like, if you don't have fun while you're doing this, like, why do you do it in the first place? So there's always time for a joke here and there, or the beat down that somebody's going to get. Always time for that.
Awesome. Yeah, you don't want it to feel like work.
No. God, this is far from work. I mean, we all do jobs, so why would we want this to be work? So there's no way that we want this to be work. So it's like, no, not at all. Not at all.
So that's actually leads me into my next question. A lot of people talk about how hard it gets when, you get a little older and you get a full-time job. Daryl, you have one of the busiest jobs. You work in an ER. How do you balance that with your family, the band?
it's really difficult. There was a time when I didn't really understand how to do that, right? To balance things. And I would talk about spinning plates on, like a circus performer, plates would drop and they'd break. And I really had to go and evaluate what my priorities really are. And I did. I had to look and say, hold on, what the hell am I doing? What are my priorities? What is the thing? And music is something that I enjoy, and it's a part of me. And I do it because it helps me to balance out some of the other stuff that I do, with
the
medicine.
Intense work.
The intense work. So I can release, this energy in another way that's productive. But I still had to find the priorities of other things to balance life. You can't be all one thing. And, I learned something about the word priorities. I read this in this book, Determined. It's about, physician burnout, all these things. And I learned that, the word priorities was actually just a singular word till the 1900s. It wasn't a plural word at all.
Oh, wow.
And they had this exercise of listing your top 10 priorities. And so you had to list them all, and they had to be really specific, and then list only your top 3 priorities, and realize that whenever you do something, you have to really see whether or not it's worthwhile to take that and move it into one of these top 3 spots. Mm. And so I know where my top 3 priorities actually lie. I had to really look at that and figure out where that was. And it's like, wow, it's a self-reflective thing. We have to go, dude, get your shit straight, right? Mm-hmm. Get your shit straight. And so I know where they are. And the thing is, I have very supportive individuals who are in those priorities that help me to still do this, to plan a band. It is something that helps to rejuvenate me in a way that's, different than anything else. My family really does give me the passport to do it. They allow me to do that. They support this.
That's great.
But that realizing that I put them also, I have to put them at a higher level of priority and say, there's certain things I can't do with the band because it's my priorities are here. We get offered to do something and it's like, well, my daughter has a dance competition. I have to go to that. I'm not going to sit there and go, well, I got to do my thing for me and go play at a band. It's like, nah, my kids are young. I got to be there.
Gotta be there.
That's great. I love the opportunities that have been afforded to me from playing in a band and the ones that will come up from doing this. And, some of them I know I won't be able to do because I have to make decisions that involve my other priorities. And my job is being one of those things too. It is my profession is its own priority in itself. That's the thing that sustains, you know, my way of living, right? But it's also something that I love doing. You know, I'm called to do that. I'm called to be in the helping profession that I'm in. And it's cool that I can, you know, take care of people at one of the worst times in their lives and, you know, make a difference in that way. And then also people have said I made a difference because of the music that we play, which is really cool. You know, it's like this unique, you know, existence where, you know, if you take the brackets and put where I'm at, it's like, that's unique. The experiences I have in life have been, you know, fantastic. It's the stuff made of, you know, stories. Mm-hmm. And I'm really lucky to have people around me that are very supportive of me and that help me to still play in a band at this age, with my profession throughout all of my years. That's the one thing that I can't trade for anything. And I'm really thankful for that. I'm really thankful for that.
Must be nice to release that energy. I've seen pictures of you, Daryl, in midair with your leg up and your hair flying. So
yeah, it's
definitely pretty, seems like it's a good release.
It is a good release, you know, and I try not to let the two worlds ever meld together. That's a thing. I try to keep them as separate as possible. But I mean, it's sometimes difficult because I can't hide really that well, you know, 6'4.5", you know, guy with dreadlocks who, you know, happens to be a physician and people go, hey, you're that doctor. I saw you on this thing or saw this billboard with your face on it. And, oh, you play in the band too. And it's like, yeah, but you know, when I'm in the hospital, I'm not even thinking about music. That doesn't even cross my mind. It's like, I don't walk in and go, hey, I'm Daryl from the Bowie Bulls. I never, it's Dr. Wilson. And that's it. There's not even a thought. And people bring it up and it's jarring and distracting to me. And it's like, it's not appropriate. You know, it's not one of those things that's an appropriate discussion. There's certain things where you go, yeah, you wouldn't, you know, walk into you wouldn't go to a mission in a country that's having a famine and then just like start grabbing, you know, large buckets of food out of some cornucopia and just like start throwing food on the ground. I mean, that wouldn't be your thing to do. That'd be a very inappropriate response. It'd be something that'd be pathological in your brain. And to me, it's like, it's not appropriate for me to discuss, you know, punk rock in the hospital. I mean, if somebody wants to ask me and it's downtime, sure. But during patient care, it's like, we're here to take care of patients. I'm not here to talk about this. Oh, you stage dive all the time. Like, but I'm not going to jump off the gurney. It's like, I got to take care of this. I can put a central line in you right now. That's what I'm doing. It's like, this isn't the time to talk about that.
Yeah. You don't want someone talking to you about power cords in your doctor's office the same way you don't want someone coming up to you backstage and saying, hey, can you look at this lump on my arm?
Yeah, but you know, that happens probably more often than not.
Oh, no.
So that's the thing. So that's where, you know, I can at least, you know, kind of tailor the whole punk rock part while I'm in the hospital. But I'm always a physician, too. That doesn't turn off when I'm walking on the street or if I'm doing something else. It's like there's been multiple times that people have been injured at a show.
Oh, wow. Including
our bass player, you know, it's like,
is there a doctor in the house?
And there is, and there happens to be the ability for me to respond in that way as well, which is, I'm happy to do that because that's what I do. That is still a part of what I do. So, you know, that part will cross over more often than actually the hospital. I don't think it's really going to be helpful to the patient with chest pain. If so, they go, hey, you know, if you listen to the new record, I mean, it'd be great if you heard that. It might be great in this time.
What do you think?
Really help you out. You know, is your heart rate at the same beats per minute that Pete's playing the drums? So, yeah, you had a SBT. Your heart is 220 beats per minute right now. I mean, that's not going to be an appropriate discussion. Oh, so I try to keep them separate as much as possible.
That'd be amazing. Before we get into some of these songs, I just want to ask, how'd you guys connect with Toby and Red Scare?
That's funny. You know, so I remember we were trying to set up a show a long time ago with the copyrights at Cobra Lounge. And I'd written to Toby and, you know, said, hey, I'd love to play with your band, blah, blah, and all these things. You know, they're on Red Scare. And it never came through. And then I did this Riot Fest. I did this panel that we were on to talk about like Chicago punk rock history, things like that. And I was saying some stuff about punk rock and making jokes with all the guys because we're all joking around with each other. We all knew each other. And Toby wrote something like, I'm gonna paraphrase because I'm not gonna directly quote him. He's like, who the hell is this, you know, caveman up there talking about punk rock and disrespecting all these other people? I'm like, disrespecting? We're just busting balls because we're Chicago guys busting balls on each other. He's like, how dare you? And so he's talking, and so he was like, just beating me down. I'm like, okay, he doesn't know me. And so we'd run into each other, and I'd say, you know, we were internet friends for a long time because we were like internet friends. And so we'd talk and we'd talk. And I remember, you know, Ken asking Toby at one point, you know, about we're going to put out a record. This was a long time ago. We have a 7-inch. We're going to put out a record, blah, blah, blah. And Toby's like, well, I'll just give you my opinion. I mean, I would never put out a band from you. I would put out a record from you guys ever. I mean, I'd never put out, unless you're doing a split with Rise Against, I'm never putting out a record from you guys.
Oh, wow.
This is his quote. And it's like, okay, well, that's straight up. So, I mean, we've become friends over time. And we would hang out at shows and talk and just do our thing. And Ken, when we had like the demos and things put down, he's like, well, I'm going to send this out to a bunch of labels and see what they think. And he said, I'm going to send it to Red Scare. And we're like, ah, okay, that's fine. It's like, Toby's not going to put it out. It's like, so he sent it, and you know, it's Toby and Brendan. So we've known Brendan forever. And Brendan's like, yeah. And Toby's like, yeah, we're going to put this out. We'd love to do it. But you have to change. You have to get it mixed differently. It has to be mixed differently. And so Ken was like, what? How dare it sound so good? Like, maybe we should do this, you know? And Joe, you know, Joe Principe was like, hey, he'd heard the demos. And he said, no, he's one of my best friends, right? And he didn't ever send full criticism. He just said, hey, maybe you should get this mixed to the Blasting Room. I said, and I'm like, what? You mean like Rise Against Blasting Room mixed, you know, Descendants? I'm like, come on, I don't have that kind of money. He's like, I'm not in Rise Against. I'm just making jokes like that. And he goes, no, you should do it. Have Chris Beeble mix it. And I'm like, okay. So I looked into it and I said, yeah, let's do it. So we sent it there. And it came back, and it is Chris, phenomenal job. Love him to death. He knows what we are to sound like. Like I've said on multiple interviews, I'm going to say it again. He will always mix our stuff no matter what. That is the guy. No one else will touch it. It's got to be Chris Beeble who mixes it. That's just the way it has to be, because he is our spirit animal. He is the guy that knows. And so it was kind of this whole long, drawn out, you know, thing with Toby, you know, and Red Scare. That's of funny. Just kind of hanging out and being buddies. And finally he breaks down and realizes that, oh, they're really good. You know, so maybe we could do that. And it's great. I mean, we love Toby. Toby's great. We're all like to bust each other's chops on things and make jokes. And it is a great relationship. And I mean, and Brendan's a part of this. So, you know, Brendan forever, it's just great. And we like to make fun, and they're really supportive of us, which is really, really good. I mean, and we're loyal to who's supporting us by any means. You know, it is definitely a match, like, you know, peanut butter and chocolate came together and the Reese's was formed. So there you go. So we're like that Reese's peanut butter cup now, which is awesome.
Well, that's great. Well, congratulations. That's awesome.
Yeah. He never put out a record by us. Never put out a record by you guys. Let's split with Rise Against. Well, Toby, you're a liar. Thank God you're a liar, Toby.
Eat your words.
Let's eat those words.
And good on Joe to recommend the Blasting Room. That really made the difference.
Yes. But I he didn't really make such a push to recommend. He kept saying, oh, maybe, but oh yeah, whatever you want to do. I'm like, Just say it. Just say it. Just say those
words. Give
it to me
straight. Come on.
Yeah. He's like, well, I didn't want to, you know, hurt your feelings. Like, how are you going to hurt my feelings? It's like, come on. I don't have any emotions. You can't hurt my feelings.
I'm tough.
Right.
Daryl, I want to jump into some of these songs here, and I want to start with the last song, which is actually the first single, Liniment and Tonic. And this is a song about stress relief. So we heard a little bit about how you can release some of that work stress with playing shows. But what are the boll weevils' go-to stress relievers?
You know, really the one for me primarily is playing music. That's a big stress reliever in itself. You know, and the song metaphorically, the Liniment and Tonic can be anything that's a stress reliever. And it kind of came out of this whole, the song was written almost, well, on a whim. We were kind of sitting around thinking we were going to write some drinking song because we were going to play Rebellion Fest and think we got to write some like drinking song. And I was talking in a very, 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 very poor English accent. I will never, it's rude. I won't even pretend.
I won't ask you to do it. Yeah.
No, please. I wouldn't do it because it'd offend all my friends in England. I'm not going to do that to them.
Is that what we sound like?
Yeah, no, that's how I sound like an idiot. That's what I sound like. So, you know, I was like, this is a drinking song and blah, blah, you know, called Liniment and Tonic. And so it was like a medicinal, thinking about a medicinal thing to make sure you can get your ailments out. And so we wrote it, the chorus came along, it was catchy. We're like, yeah, this song's good. And yeah, really thinking about, yeah, what are the things that people do when they are working so hard and you're doing backbreaking stuff, whatever it is, whether it's mentally backbreaking, whether it is physically backbreaking, you know, what is it that people do to find relief for those things? And most people find relief in self-medicating, unfortunately, with drinking and things like that. And, you know, not to say that this band has times that they drink, because we've been known to drink sometimes. But I think that, you know, and we created a drink, by the way, with the song. So there's a song, a drink created with the song.
Nice.
But I think the Liniment and Tonic can be anything that you use to relieve those stressors that are around. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, a lot of times it's hanging out with your friends at a bar or hanging out at some other event that you're going to go to. It could be, you know, needlepoint. It could be, you know, sex. It could be, you know, whatever. But the Liniment and Tonics for each individual is unique. Like I said, mine primarily is playing in the band. It's one of those things that's, you know, my Liniment and Tonic. With, you know, Ken, it's probably alcohol. With Pete, it's probably alcohol. And with Pete, it's probably alcohol. So, I mean, so those are the things that are there, but I can't speak for them that that's the case. I mean, but I mean, yeah, I mean, we've had Liniment and Tonics here and there. I mean, they'll be on special at places for this show too,
that's
our show. So, but I mean, it is a, that song was fun. And it's an earworm. It hits you.
Oh, totally.
And it stays with you.
I've had stuck away for days.
Yes, and it doesn't go away, which is good.
Impressed that you could get out Liniment and Tonic again, like over and over again, without like tripping over those words.
I think I had many Liniment and Tonics before me, the whole thing put it out. So, but no, it is a fun song. I love the melody in it and the kind of the message behind it too. And it makes you go, wow. It kind of makes you think the day's over. I'm going to just relax. And this is what I'm going to listen to. I'm going to have my smile on and have my Liniment and Tonic in my hands, whatever that may be, and go from there and go on to the next day.
That's great. We talked a little bit about Galt's Gulch, but I want to know who was reading Atlas Shrugged when you wrote this song.
I read that a long time ago, actually. Yeah. I read The Fountainhead and, you know, Atlas Shrugged. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny because you read the, if you're really young and you read those books, you, oh my God, this is, and then you go, as you mature and look at things, you go, this is not plausible. Nothing in this is plausible.
Yeah.
It's like a work of fiction, and you know, the people just abandon basically, you know, society and say we're better and we're going to go off and do this because all you takers are taken from us and we're we're, you know, it's okay. Communities, you need to be able to help people in communities to rise and make all the boats float if you can. Yeah. And this idea that we're sold on scarcity, there's not enough to go around for all people, is so ridiculous. And it continues to, you know, cause more individuals to become more anxious and vile towards other individuals, believing that there's not enough, which I think is crazy.
Yeah.
Now, do I think everybody is going to abuse things if you're handed something? No, I don't think that's the case. I mean, could it happen? Yeah, some people will, but
sure.
I don't think that we should turn our backs on our fellow human beings and, you know, not be willing to give a hand up to people. People say they hate to put a hand out, but you're putting a hand out to grab somebody to help lift them up. That's what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, children, you know, are the thing we understand are dependent upon all of us to give them hands to pull them up. And if you leave people in a state of kind of being thought of as children all the time, no, you build up people so they can continue to go and flourish on their own and fly. But you can't say to a kid, you know, hey, pull up your bootstraps and go. It's like the kid can't even walk. You know, they're human beings are dependent on other human beings for a long time. For all of our lives are dependent on human beings. I mean, as we're young and as we get older. So the song in itself is almost, it's parodying the sense of saying the uncaring person who's like, I'm so independent, who's John Galt, shrugging their shoulders and walking around like, who gives a crap about your issues? I can't see what's wrong with you because I'm living that my best life. So fuck off, who's John Galt? That's yeah. what it is. And you know, that's such a cop-out in its own way, right? It doesn't make you have any culpability for anything. When we all are kind of culpable for one, taking care of ourselves in our yard, but at the same time, it's like when your neighbor's house is on fire, you're not going to sit back and go, well, who's John Galt? That place burning down. It's like, no, you're going to try and help them out.
Look at that fire.
The inclination for human beings is to try to help other human beings out. That's our base, base thing for us to exist. If we didn't do that, we would not survive as a species. We would be wiped out. If we tried to go back to, you know, our days of hunter gatherers and we're hunting together in a party, if you go hunt on your own, you're going to end up getting hunted by the predators that are out there and you're not going to make it back to bring the spoils of the hunt home. So we're inclined to work together to try and move in a direction forward. If we don't do that, we keep stumbling backwards and we will end up, you know, losing against the universe that is totally uncaring about us. Right. You know, that's the thing. So that's kind of the whole thing with Galt's Gulch. You listen to it and people go, are you supporting this or not? But it's kind of like tongue in cheek saying, who's John Galt is what it is. It's a tongue in cheek version of that.
Well, we definitely stand on many legs, and I wish more people would realize that. Yeah, the helping your neighbor put out the fire, but also the little things. You know, all the little things are really important too. Helping each other out in just your basic ways can actually make such a huge difference.
Right, right. And even Ayn Rand took handouts, so let's not forget that.
The Cutting Solution is a look at psychiatric illness and suicide attempts that maybe you have experienced in your work with the ER, in the ER.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit more about that song.
Yeah, that came out of, you know, seeing this dramatic rise in psychiatric emergencies in the ED, and really seeing a huge spike in not just adolescents, but even younger kids coming in to the emergency department. I'm talking, you can see kids as young as 6 years old coming in with behavioral problems that are not something you'd see typically. And it is distressing. It is a generation of individuals that are lost. And, you know, it's like you want to look and go, what is it that we can do to make this better? You can't throw a band-aid on it. One thing, a lot of times you look at, it's funding for things. A lot of times we don't have funding all the time for these things, and we don't, you know, take it seriously to really, we have lip service where people go, oh my God, think about the children. Like, you know, Reverend Lovejoy's wife, you know, in The Simpsons, what about the children? Yeah. It's like, yeah, what about them? You say these things that, you know, as a talking head or a leader who is out there saying, this is what I see, this problem, it's so horrible. But it's like, well, okay, what are you going to put behind this? I mean, what are you willing to sacrifice to make this better, you know, versus this young person's life? How do we fund, you know, psychiatric care? How do we actually find, you know, preventative solutions for problems so that the individual doesn't believe that it's time for me to take this as a solution to cut myself or to find a way to self-harm? You know, how do we help to have parents have better coping skills so they can be mirrored by their children? You know, we have a generation of adults and young adults who have children, and they aren't able to mirror the ability to cope with stressors in some ways. And then they see that, and that's how they get perpetually trained on how to respond to things. How do we give individuals tools that will allow them to not succumb to this constant onslaught of, you know, negative influences that try to tell you that you're not good enough, that you're not smart enough, that you're not thin enough, that you're not, you know, working hard enough, that, you know, when do people realize, no, I'm enough, you know, and that's it. It's not the thing. The carrot that is put in front of people perpetually is this carrot that's just rotted, and you're chasing it, and you don't even see that it's rotted because no one's taught you that that's rotten vegetables. You don't eat that. That's hard. So there's a lot of things that you run into in life aren't really problems. And hear me out when I say this. A problem is something that has a simple solution of 1 + 1 = 2. That is a problem. That is a simple thing that has a number set that goes on to, you know, get another number in the end. That's a problem. We're dealing with dilemmas, and dilemmas are things that are more nebulous, that they're not simply solved by just saying, here's what it is. Dilemmas require, you know, strategies to try to help to get to a better end. It may not solve the whole thing, but at least helps you start to grow and learn how to, you know, work towards this better virtue of where the end should be, the good end is. And so I think that we have this, you know, mental health dilemma that's out there. And some of the problems that are unfortunately fueling it are underfunding of things, you know, episodic care that individuals get, you know, the constant onslaught of forces on the developing brain that doesn't allow it to rebound well. You know, when you're constantly having a dopamine hit, an endorphin hit from getting these messages on your social media platform, and in a developing brain, it's like, how's that working to its advantage? I mean, brains aren't developed till you're 25 years old. So, you know, how do you avoid this? And you know, I was having a meeting about this today. The things that we're subjected to now in our time weren't things that I was subjected to as a young person. We didn't have, you know, social media or the internet like we did when I was growing up.
And everything,
you know, for the ability for bullying to occur with individuals 24/7. It's like you can't avoid. You could at least say, I'm not in school today. I'm not going to have to deal with that bully because they can't get a hold of me. They don't have my phone number. They don't mm-hmm. have the ability to get a hold of me. But now it's like, you just can't escape it. And it's like that feeling of individuals that are trapped in this dystopian type of thing. But at the same time, do we keep perpetuating this level of dystopia by saying that everything's horrible, everything's bad, everything's, it's like, you look around and go, well, God, that's like thinking that, you know, you see one plane crash and every plane's going to fall out of the sky. That's mm-hmm. not, mm-hmm. that's not the truth. So that's the thing, and finding truth in things, you know, it's hard for people to even seek that out when people seek information in places and can't filter it. It's all these factors that go in, and all that factors into seeing this rise in psychiatric emergencies, whether it's in the very young, which is a big concern because this is a generation that's going to go on and try to then continue to navigate the world and not have this fear of the world, you hope. But even in the adults that are beyond that and in the elderly, people like to blame the pandemic for all of it. But I mean, this frog's been boiling in the pot for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's now finally come to the point where the frog realizes, oh my God, I'm dying here. This is where you get to this critical juncture and you've already passed over and you're like, wow, there were warning signs before. I mean, I've been walking in the coal mine with a canary for the longest time and I've seen the canary die and I've tried to warn people to say, this is a problem.
Yeah.
Yet other people are like, I don't see it. I don't see the problem. It's like, well, the canary is dead.
Yeah.
It's like, we have to get out of here. There's poison.
Here are the signs. Yeah.
Here's the signs. So yeah, Cutting Solutions, really, you know, a song that I kind of wrote. I didn't kind of write, I wrote the lyrics because of all the continued psychiatric emergencies that were rising and rising and still are. Mm-hmm. And hopefully knowing that the solution isn't cutting this away. It's trying to find a way to realize that, hey, you are somebody, you are important. Yeah. You know, and if you are having, you know, thoughts of wanting to harm yourself or harm others, you know, there's help that you can get. And you know, it's funny that people always think about the disease of psychiatric disease is it's like these individuals have to suffer with it in some sense, because we had this conversation today. When you find out a person in your neighborhood has cancer, suddenly there's the influx of people who are rushing to the home to make meals and cut mm-hmm. grass and do all these things, where community seems to rally around the individual with the disease process.
Yes, raise money, yep.
But as soon as the person has a substance abuse disorder or has some psychiatric care that requires inpatient hospitalization, suddenly people become these pariahs. They're ostracized. And it is like nobody comes to rally around to say, what can we do to help you? It's like, this is something that nobody wants to touch. And so it's that kind of stuff that we as a nation, we as a world have to look at it and go, why are we so unhappy? Why is it that, you know, antidepressants are one of the most prescribed medications in the United States, but nobody seems to be happy? Doesn't make any sense. So are we really looking at our well-being? Are we really looking at how we you know, choose our priorities and things? And I think the pandemic did kind of make individuals really evaluate some of those things as well, too.
Yeah,
that people might have been living in this lifestyle of, oh God, I'm climbing this corporate ladder, I'm doing this stuff. And then suddenly they're like, oh man, that doesn't even matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what matters is like, my priorities, what really matters is like my family, these things, and I can take less or I should demand more. I shouldn't be doing this. And then that's the kind of this tectonic shift in the way that things are going. It's like this, we're in this really, you know, time of change, which is really amazing, you know, that we're living through this. And I think people understand that and we see it, but it's also making people fearful because they don't know what the outcome will be.
Right,
but we've done this before.
Known.
As communities, as human beings, we have done this throughout all of our existence on this planet. Mm-hmm. So we're just happen to be experiencing it right now. And realize if you go back and you look back through history, you'll see these things have happened before. This is not something brand new. And in fact, we're probably better equipped to deal with it versus people were back in the 16th century or in ancient Rome. We're better equipped to deal with these things. And people think suddenly, oh man, doom is coming. You got the guy with the, you know, the sign on that's over their head, you know, the end is near. It's been near forever. And you know, when it finally comes, hey, it's going to finally come, but at least, you know, live well while you can.
Absolutely. Well, I teach fifth grade and I meet a lot of kids, and I, you know, listening to you say all that was really powerful. I want to add, you know, one thing I wish that more people would realize is that they got to take kids more seriously, you know, and that you'll often hear them say, oh, you'll grow out of it, or it's a phase, or, oh, it's not so bad. You know, I got bullied when I was a kid. You know, so like just taking kids more seriously and listening to them and understanding that, yeah, you might have a young kid. You might have a 10-year-old that has depression, you know?
Right, right. So, and you can't sit there and go, suck it up. It's hold on a second. They're not going to be fine. And that doesn't help. The acknowledgement that there's a problem is the first thing to allow you to tackle that problem.
Yeah.
So to avoid it, because I think the stigmatizing hits that people feel, parents feel like suddenly they're a failure at things. It's no, it's recognizing this. Sometimes it's cultural things that will not allow people to actually seek the care, so that kids don't come to their families and ask them, they're talking to somebody else about it. It's like all these things. It's like, we need public service announcements that say, and people say it all the time, it's okay not to be okay. Sure. Okay. It's okay not to be okay. But now then, what are you going to do about it? That's right. The thing. You can't sit back and just say, I'm going to anchor this and that's it. You, everything that we do has to come from, we're going to make a decision and a choice of how we're going to respond. That's all we can control. Everything else outside of us, totally not in our control, not at all. And once you realize that, it cuts a lot of your anxiety away, and realizing, what can I do? It's my response to things that I can only control.
That's what you can control. Yeah.
That's all I can control. If I try and control the universe, I'm going to go nuts because I can't do it. Mm-hmm. And the universe is going to look back and go, I don't care.
Sorry.
I don't care. So that's where you go. The universe inside of me is the only thing I can control. And once you take control of that, it's like, cool, got it. I'm accepting this right now because that's all I can do. And I can go on from there. Yep. So, I mean, emotions are real though. Don't get me wrong. Emotions are real. You get a physiologic response to all kinds of things, but then you have to sit there and say, what am I going to do with this? Mm-hmm. What am I going to do with this?
Sure.
Sitting still doesn't make it disappear. It's like, okay, I'm responding with a fear response because there's a tiger in the room. If I just sit back and go, I'm going to stay here and quake in my boots, you're dead. The tiger is going to eat you. If you suddenly go, hey, why is this run of adrenaline coming through me? Why is this epinephrine hitting all my receptors to make my muscles get fired? Oh, so I should run. That's my response. I'm going to run now. Mm-hmm. And if I get away, cool. I'm going to go, that door's not the door. That's the tiger door. Don't go through that door.
It's the thing. It's the cage it came from.
Exactly. So don't go in there.
All right, so on a more lighthearted note, dancing, we're just straight romancing. I love theme. how did theme come about?
So that was one that we were working on for a while as well. It was on the 7-inch that we put out on Underground Communique. That was like 8-9 years ago, something like that.
Yeah.
And that song was, we were truly messing around at practice one day, just messing around and sort of playing this funky riff, you know, Bob was playing at the time. And I'm like, we should have a dance. We should have like a dance associated with our band, something like that. I started doing this weird spastic kicking and punching thing and made it sort of make up the lyrics about it, you know? And at the time, you know, our bass player was like, we're never playing that song. We're never gonna do that. That's not gonna happen. And then he left the band. And so he left. I'm like, we're doing that song. We're so we got this song, and it came about and grew organically as well too. And it's like one of those things that you put down and go, are you seriously going to say this? I'm like, of course. It's like, it's funny. It's like, you gotta have a theme song, right? Every band's gotta have a theme song. So this is our theme song, and it's boastful, but it's of course poking fun at us. I mean, we're taking this whole thing and like, okay,
it's fun.
How seriously are you going to take ourselves? It's like, this is not, thing, if it's not fun, Why do you do it?
Right.
And so if we're having fun, you should be having fun too. And here you go. And it's a fun little ditty. And it also is one of those things that also hits you as an earworm where you go, why are you writing these, you know, hooks and things like that? It's like, because that's what you want to do. You want to have a good time. It's like, yeah. Punk rock show's fun. We're a fun band. So that came out. And theme is fun. It's my kids love it. They sing along, and it's like they knew a lot of our songs before, but I remember when we had that written and my kids would hear it, and they came to a show and I'm watching them and they're singing every lyric. I'm like, get out of town. Like, those my kids know every lyric to that.
That's
I'm like,
funny.
That's good.
Well, yeah, you gotta loosen good people up, you know.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's our Robber Room song.
So tell me about this Benoit album art.
Oh yeah. So Ken actually was instrumental in getting that done. We were one going through all these iterations of what the album would be called. Mm-hmm. And you know, like, is there gonna be old dude still doing it? All this stuff, you know, stuff like that.
Bull Weevil's and, Return.
Right. You know, is it Stick Your Neck Out Part 2? Is it, you know, heavier weights, you know, it's like stuff like that. But, you know, Essential kind of came out of the whole thing of the pandemic and all of us thinking, yeah, this is what we're essential workers. But at the same time, the idea of the essential need of all of us as human beings together working towards a common goal of trying to survive, right? And so Ken had taken the idea of what we were talking about, essential, and took it to Benoit. And Ken's like, I'm going to get... you know, Benoit to do this. He kept saying that. I'm like, okay, that's fine. I don't have any tattoos, but that's cool. And they all got tats. And it's like, okay, we're going to go. So he took it to Benoit, and, you know, Benoit came up with this, you know, wheel and, you know, these spokes in the wheel of all these different arms that are kind of holding the wheel together. The center is the Chicago Star, and emanating from that are all these different arms that are holding this wheel that's going around. It's got the city's, you know, landscape in it. That's
really cool.
You know, landscape. And it's kind of like, wow, the essential need for everybody to really hold the wheel of life together and have it moving. If you don't have all those spokes of all these different individuals holding on, nothing works. They're all essential to make it work. And that's kind of cool. Like, the whole concept of that was like, this is cool. And having him do it too, who's just a great artist, is like just amazing. So that was kind of the whole thing of having an amazing artist put together this amazing, you know, piece of art to go on the record that we think is an amazing piece of art, and having their interpretation of what that is, which kind of fit to the theme of it all, which kind of just made it perfect. So yeah. that was all Ken. Ken made that happen.
Oh, that's great.
Talking to Ben and getting it done.
It's a great cover.
Thank you. Thank Ben, because I mean that's
Ben. Someone's got to get the tattoo now.
Well, Ken has it actually. Ken has it on his back, so he does. It has it between his, you know, scapulas. He's got it. So awesome. I'm like, wow, that's cool. He came. He's look what I got. I'm like, look at you.
Closing down, I got a few more questions for you, Daryl. I wanted to hear a little bit more about those sold out shows you recently did with Rise Against the Metro, right?
Yeah.
How was that? So
that was awesome. That was, you know, we played that Thursday night, you know, the 30th of March. They had it, you know, their three nights they were doing their residency at the Metro. And they wanted to get, you know, three local bands to play. And, you know, we had, you know, heard it was happening, talked about it, you know, put our hat in the ring. And you know, it was like, it could have happened or it could have not happened. I mean, sure. We knew there was a chance it might have not happened, but it was, hey, we've been friends with them forever. It's like, hey, think about us as we're a Chicago band. You know, we've been playing forever too. We played with them in 2009 at the Metro back in the day for their 10th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And that we played the Metro for their 9th anniversary, played at the Metro for their 40th anniversary, which is kind of a cool little thing. And it was amazing to get the call to do it, to play with our friends, you know, and family, basically. And, you know, Rise Against, one of my daughter's favorite bands. One of my twin daughters, her favorite band is Rise Against. She had a chance to hang out with them backstage.
Yeah, wow.
but I mean, it was great to be out there and perform for a fans that might have not ever heard of us or seen us, but knew our relationship kind of with the band, because, hey, these guys have known us forever because when they grew up, or they played with us because they played in other bands around us. And being at Chicago at the Metro of all places, which is the mecca of all places to play, yeah, the greatest venues on the planet. It is the greatest venue on the planet. It was great to be in front of this crowd and perform like we perform and have them see us, and then, you know, go, oh my God, those guys are, that's a Chicago punk rock band.
Yeah,
that's really good. And we made some new fans, which is really cool.
That's great.
We had a lot of people supporting us when we came out. Oh, it was great. The response was great. It was overwhelmingly, you know, positive. I'm like, unbelievable. It's like, this is really, really cool. I even was, you know, gracious enough to ask if I could stage dive on them, because I didn't want to, you know,
jump on you.
It's like, just, usually I stage dive during this song if you've never seen us before. So is it okay? And they gave consent. So I got consent to stage dive. You know, that's the thing. We live in a new world. You can't just dive people. You got to get consent. So I didn't have them sign waivers though. Thank God. But it was a really wonderful night, you know, like my family was all there, you know, and my buddies and Rise Against, our family too, all of us as a band hanging out with them, you know, playing in front of that room, in that room, for, you know, 40 years of the Metro, which I hope that there's another 80 years of the Metro. Once again, it's these experiences that you get to have by playing in a band are the things that you really cherish and you remember out of all of it. You know, it's not like, you know, we're making exorbitant amounts of money, you know, playing in a band. It's like, we do it because it's, you get to have these unique experiences in life that you will remember. That's going to be the thing you remember on your deathbed, or what experiences you had in life. Not, once again, all the material stuff that you garnered. It's going to be the relationships, people that you had, the experiences that you had with those people. That's going to flash before your eyes before you die.
Yeah. The stuff you create, the stuff you leave behind. Right. Absolutely.
Right.
Well, that's amazing. It looked like a lot of fun. I can't imagine how much you guys must've been dying to get your record out at that point. Like, let's get this out. shows like those.
Yeah. It's like, oh man, this is, and it's that high of that, you know, you hit that and you're like, we did this now in a, you know, a couple months, the record's going to come out. It's like, this is going to be really cool. It's like, we're just getting all this momentum built up. All these little things are fueling this perpetual motion of this thing that keeps going on. So it's like really awesome. Like, you're striking while the iron is hot for once versus hitting it and then walking away, which, you know, we did for so many 28 years or whatever. It's that, you know, experience of having that opportunity to play with, you know, Rise Against, and to play at the Metro, just is amazing. And it's just fuel that helps keep this thing moving.
Any plans going forward once the record comes out? When the album comes out, this episode will come out after the record. Yeah. So I hope people get it, and I hope they love it, because it's great.
Yes.
What are your plans going forward?
So yeah, the record's out, you know, May 5th it came out, which is amazing record. I hope you are listening to it. And then we have a show in Montreal on the 20th of May. That'll be our first show post the record being released. We'll be in Montreal at Pooza Fest, which is an amazing festival in Montreal. Love Montreal as a city. Love Pooza Fest. It's a great festival. You know, it's going to be a great show, playing with a bunch of bands from Red Scare, playing with Brutal Youth, which is a great band out of Toronto. If you haven't listened to that band, you have to listen to Brutal Youth. They are amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Love those guys. They're a great band, great people. Their record just came out too. They're spot on. The record's awesome. Then we come back and we play our record release show in Chicago on May 27th.
That's so right.
The hopefully dopamines? You guys got your tickets. Yeah, the Dopamines are going to be playing with us.
That'd be awesome.
It's going to be rad payoff. It's going to be The Reaganomics. It's going to be butchered. So it's going to be a great show at the Chop Shop. Get your tickets for that. Hopefully you will see everybody out there. You have already got the record in hand and you're listening to the song so you can sing along, which will be awesome. And then we have some other shows coming up. Sometimes summer, we're going to have a couple other shows we're going to be playing that haven't been really announced yet. We have one coming up in August, which is going to be really cool, that we're planning out in California for our old label, Dr. Strange, which will be really cool. So nice. That'll be a great, great, great time, great show. Kind of the heroes coming back to California to come on back to Dr. Strange for a little bit. towards the end of the year, we have a couple of shows. Of course, we got Fest
right.
At the end of the year. Yep. So we got two sets we're playing at Fest. So that'll be cool. Fest is always great. One of the best festivals around. It's just a great time. But we'll see. Probably other things will pop up in between that span of time. So just keep it locked. Go to Red Scare and see tour dates for things. Go to our Facebook and our Instagram, to find out where we are. And follow our antics and all of our shenanigans. Our shenanigans.
Well, Daryl, it's been a blast talking with you, man. I've really appreciated your time tonight, taking me through this record. Like I said, I love it. I can't wait for it to be out there. I can't wait for people to hear it. It's really the hard work shows. It shines through.
Thank you. I stand behind it 1,000%. It is like the best thing we put out so far. We got to start working on the next stuff. It won't be, 14 years before
you put something else out.
It definitely, we're going to put on anything that's quality. And this is something that we are backing behind 1,000%. We think it is a great record. It is fantastic. When you hear it, you're going to know it's a great record. And we are totally, totally behind it. If you don't think it's a great record, that's on you. We do. We know it's a great record. So, we love it. We love it.
Oh, that's great.
Thank you, dude. This was awesome.
Appreciate it.
Awesome. Appreciate you, man.
Awesome. Take care.
You too, man. Thanks.
Okay, and that about does it here for this episode. I would like to thank Daryl for hanging out with me tonight and talking about Essentials, telling us a little bit about how this record came to be. I'd like to thank Katie Hovland for connecting me with Daryl. I would like to thank Krista Makes from Less Than Jake for the theme music. I would like to thank all of you for listening to this podcast as often as you do, or if this is your first time, thank you. I really do appreciate you spending some time listening to this podcast. It's a labor of love. It's an opportunity to talk about the records that we love. It's an opportunity to maybe hopefully turn you on to some new records, right? Whether you listen because you've heard of the band before or you're listening because you want to check something new out, my singular goal is just to provide people with more information on this stuff that I love so much. And you must love it too. And I appreciate that. So check us out on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're out there. Check us out. Interact with us. We love to talk music. All right, everybody. I'm going to get out of here. Until next time, take care. Bye-bye.